Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Abraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Martin Ford, globally renowned writer, best-selling author, keynote, and futurist. Martin, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Martin, you've had some amazing success. You've been able to predict trends in the marketplace way before institutions like Cambridge and Oxford and so on. So congratulations on that success.
Well, thank you.
Now, Martin, can you share some key takeaways from your book, The Lights in the Tunnel?
Well, the basic idea of that book was that, you know, artificial intelligence and robotics was ultimately going to have a big impact on human employment. And what I proposed in the book was ultimately we would need something along the lines of a guaranteed income. And I proposed some sort of modifications to that to make it more feasible. But I do think that that's what lies in our future, that we're going to have to essentially move away from this model where everyone in our society has to have a job that provides an income in order to survive and, you know, not be living on the street. That's probably not going to be sustainable given the trends that we see.
Now, you have this other book, The Rise of the Robots, and, Financial Times Book of the Year, McKinsey Book of the Year, New York Times bestseller. You've been in all the media because you're just in such demand. And can you talk about some of the takeaways from that book?
Well, that book is, essentially it's a refinement of the first book. The first book, The Lights in the Tunnel, was actually a self-published book, and I wrote it back in 2009. And at that time, this issue really wasn't on the radar at all. In fact, I think most people would have considered it to be kind of a fringe issue and would have, to some extent, disparaged it as a Luddite argument and so forth. And there is still some of that attitude out there, but it has changed a lot. So I published that book in 2009, and then over the 5 years or so between the two books, the issue did get a lot more visibility, and both, my book and the general trend became much more prominent, and that led to an opportunity to write the second book. And what I tried to do with the second book, which was, a traditionally published book rather than a self-published book, was to include a lot more data. The first book was really more of a thought experiment. I mean, it's a bit speculative. I was just kind of imagining what would happen if automation really took hold. Whereas in the second book, I tried to ground it more in lots of graphs and data showing that these trends are arguably already underway and already having an impact. And I also tried to provide many more real-world examples, of actual technologies or startup companies that were working in these areas and producing actual results. So most people, I think, find the second book to be more, in a sense, comprehensive and relevant to their everyday lives, because I think it provides a lot more detail.
Now, because of the success of your books and just all the media you've been doing, I know you're just at a high demand as a keynote speaker. So from your travels, can you share some of the top questions you received and your responses to them?
Well, the questions tend to be kind of the same, universally. And it doesn't matter whether you're here in the United States or you're in Europe or you're in Asia. I've been really all over the place, and the level of concern is quite high. The number one question is, what should people do about this? And they want to know two things. Number one, what should they do as individuals, or what should their kids do in order to remain relevant? And I think that's an important question. But then, of course, whenever I answer that question, I always try to push people to think a little bit more broadly than that, because it's not going to be enough that select individuals and of course the people that I talk to tend to be relatively elite groups of people. I mean, they're highly educated. A lot of them are business executives and so forth. So it's not enough to say, well, those people are going to be okay and their kids are going to be okay. We obviously need to have a solution that's much more broad based than that. And that's why I try to answer that question, but I also try to push people to think about what should we do as a society? What are we going to do to include everyone, including the people that are in the bottom half of the distribution as far as, capability goes? I mean, there is something like a normal distribution of intelligence or capability or whatever you want to call it out there, and that's to some extent unavoidable. We got to have a solution that can work for everyone, and so I really try to push it into talk of public policy and, again, the potential for maybe a guaranteed income and so forth.
You know, there are different sectors in the marketplace, and you're being, pursued by the media because of, you were years ahead of anybody else in terms of making these predictions. You're pursued by industry, again, because of being years ahead, and it's going to impact all of industry and business out there. And then governments as well. So can you talk about any sort of feedback from governments about your predictions and some of the material in your books?
Well, I find that it's just getting to the point where, governments are starting to get more interested in this. Most of the talks I give are to business groups or their conferences or universities, academic settings, those kinds. There's a lot of interest out there, and also, as you say, in the media. Governments are a bit more slow to come around. I am seeing some interest in some places. Last December, I was in The Hague in the Netherlands talking to the government ministries of that country. Later this year, I'm going to go to Austria and talk to some of their ministries. So there is sort of an emerging interest among these are the people they would call technocrats within governments. I was also just a couple of weeks ago at the White House, actually, and did a live feed discussion with the chief of staff at the White House about this. And that, I don't think that really portends this massive initiative on the part of the White House, but at least they're beginning to think about it, and they thought that this was an issue important enough to actually have a discussion and live stream it to the people to follow their Facebook page and so forth. So governments are sort of coming around. I don't think we're yet at the point where this is a big political issue that specifically we're going to see a lot of focus on, especially not in the United States. On the other hand, what I would say is that these trends and in particular the impact of technology on average people and the fact that I think it's one of the primary forces that is resulting in wage stagnation, for example, and the fact that so many of the jobs that we are creating now are these low-wage service sector jobs, I think the technology has a lot to do with that. And that's one of the things that's driving all the anger out there, which has, of course, resulted in Donald Trump and also Brexit and all those things. And, of course, the people that are caught up in that may not realize that technology is the thing driving that. They're much more likely to point to globalization or immigration and so forth. But I do think that in spite of that, technology is playing a major role there. And it could well get worse is the other thing to keep in mind.
You know, it's interesting. I just read that Facebook has something like 11,000 chatbots in their messenger service, and many people are saying this year is the year of the chatbots and intelligent agents and so on. Do you see that as having a big impact, together with robots and all this automation occurring?
Absolutely, I think that's one manifestation of this trend. I mean, obviously, it's not just about physical robots doing mechanical things; it's about machine learning algorithms, it's about chatbots, it's really a broad range, and we see one of these things, and as you say right now, chatbots becomes highly visible and people tend to focus on that, but we shouldn't lose sight that this is a very, very broad-based trend. It's all over the place, and lots of things are going to intersect. I think eventually you'll see chatbots intersect with virtual reality, so that rather than a chatbot on a device, you'll be dealing with, a full-fledged digital personality with a physical manifestation in virtual reality. And as you drive toward that, I mean, it has huge implications all over the place for the number of types of services that are going to be susceptible to this, not just to full automation, but also maybe to offshoring, the idea that you might take someone from a lower wage country and they'll be able to enter this country virtually, maybe in virtual reality or electronically, and do a lot of work, perhaps in conjunction with artificial intelligence or a chatbot and so forth. So, I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which different things intersect, and that's really going to drive this trend, I think, to really accelerate.
Martin, you come out as one of sort of these pivotal figures in the history of the world and with these two books. And do you have some sort of thinking about it, your next book, maybe some theme that you're planning?
Not really. I mean, there were, between the first two books that I wrote, there were 5 years in there. So it's only been about a year since I published the second book. So I feel I've still got some time. Right now, I am spending most of my time going around speaking about this. And also, of course, as part of that, I talk to many, many people, and I learn a lot. You know, I get a lot of examples. I hear about different countries and how this is having an impact. So I imagine all of that will shape my thinking if I do decide to write another book on this particular topic. On the other hand, maybe next time I'll want to delve into something else. One area, as I sort of mentioned, that really fascinates me and I think will have just enormous impact is virtual reality. I think that's going to be another huge trend that will have both potentially positive impacts and also potentially some negative things. There was just a report I saw just the other day that said that we have in many advanced societies a lot of young males, young men that are not working and not in school, and everyone was kind of mystified as to what they're actually doing. And there was just a study done that showed that they are spending up to 75% of their free time playing video games. And maybe that doesn't come as too much of a surprise to anyone that has got a teenager, but I really wonder about that, and I wonder how that intersects with virtual reality in the future, and what the impact on society of that is going to be. So there are a lot of, as I say, intertwined trends here that are really going to produce, I think, disruptive and unpredictable results.
You know, there's this area of financial services itself in the financial services industry. Have you thought about some of the impact and the ways it'll impact the financial services industry?
Well, yeah, I've gone around and talked to quite a few people in that industry, and one thing that they're tremendously interested in and to some extent concerned about are the so-called robo-advisors, which are these essentially smart software platforms that can do basic investment advisory. They can do things like help you balance your portfolio or allocate assets, and they provide a basic level of services, and they're becoming very popular among millennials that don't have necessarily a lot of assets, but remarkably, they're also becoming quite popular among very wealthy people. So that's one of the things that really has the industry concerned, is that some of their very best clients, the people that really have a lot of money, are also quite interested in these technologies. And if you look at the amount of assets under management, it's very small relative to the whole industry, but it's growing at basically an exponential rate. So it may well be that these are just going to have an enormous impact down the line on the business of, managing money. Also, of course, I think most people are aware by now that most trading on Wall Street is now algorithmic. I mean, estimates have ranged from 50% all the way up to 70%. And you've got these extraordinarily capable algorithms that, I mean, it's not just about placing trades. It's about really, intersecting with artificial intelligence and doing things like directly accessing machine-readable news sources and then trading on that news within tiny fractions of a second. It's about actually battling each other in a very sophisticated way. For example, placing decoy trades to try to fake out other algorithms and then withdrawing those trades and then, placing other trades. So these are there's really what's been called a whole ecosystem of predatory algorithms out there that is just enormously sophisticated. And then the other thing is that, of course, a lot of the work that's done in the financial sector is what you would call routine white-collar work. It's things like people, you've got the analysts that work on Wall Street, the people that are hired out of Ivy League schools, for example, and they go to work on Wall Street and they sit in front of a spreadsheet for 12 or more hours a day doing analysis. And Goldman Sachs, for example, just purchased a startup which is specifically focused on automating a lot of that work. So, there's a very general trend here which says that if you're a white-collar worker and you're sitting in front of a computer doing something relatively routine, cranking out the same report, doing the same kind of analysis, that is increasingly going to be susceptible. And, of course, a lot of those kinds of jobs are in the financial service sector. So it's a very broad-based impact.
Martin, because of the popularity of your books and also because of the fact that you're able to forecast very accurately what the trends years in advance and have become this historical figure that people are following, it gives you access, maybe access that you never had before. Can you talk more about that?
Well, it's true that I get to meet a lot of interesting people. I hear a lot of news, including at companies, what's going on. Some of that is not things that I can necessarily talk about, because it's told in confidence. I also meet, some fairly important figures. As I said, I was just in the White House and had a chance to actually talk to the chief of staff there. And, that's basically the number two guy in the White House, and he's really interested in this. I mean, we had a conversation, and he asked about things like guaranteed income or basic income. He asked about the threat from super intelligence. Are we someday going to have machines that wake up and take over? It's kind of interesting to see that someone at that level, with that, someone that sits down with the president every day, is in tune with these issues and has good questions. I think that's really a great thing, and it's fairly hopeful in terms of where we're going with these trends, and the hope that eventually people will understand what's going on. So, I get a lot of access, and generally that's positive, and to me it's hopeful. I'm really pleased that influential people are beginning to take an interest in this. I mean, it would be really bad, I think, if everyone just totally ignored it and wasn't thinking about it at all. But that isn't what I see. What I see is that, influential, powerful, wealthy people, the people that need to begin to care about this and understand it in order for anything to happen, those people are certainly beginning to take notice. And that's a very hopeful note, I think.
Now, a big part of my audience is also ICT executives, executives in the information communication technology industry. Is there ways that they can act on your predictions after reading your book and attending your keynotes?
Well, for a business, obviously there are two sort of separate issues here. What should a business do, and what can we do as a society? And, for a business, part of my message is that, you've got to embrace this because it's going to be an enormous disruption. I think that it wouldn't be unreasonable to say that artificial intelligence is going to totally transform the way businesses compete. You might even say it's going to be the biggest thing happening. I think that any company in any industry that isn't aware of this and at least beginning to think about it, and maybe even further along that than that, and thinking, in detail, how are they going to incorporate this into their business strategy, they're really taking a huge risk of just becoming completely irrelevant and being left behind. Because one of the things about this is that because there is an acceleration associated with this, and it's moving faster and faster, there's always going to be a very powerful first-mover advantage. I mean, the people that get it, the companies, the businesses, the industries that move into this first are going to be the ones that can really leverage it. And once they have that first-mover advantage, it may be very, very difficult to catch them. So I think it's a critical issue just from a business competitive standpoint, from business strategy, for all executives to be aware of. But then, of course, there is the bigger question: what do we do? It's to some extent, I think this is a bit like what you would call a traditional tragedy of the commons question, where what any individual business should do is pretty clear. They should go with it. They should leverage this technology. However, when everyone does that collectively, it may have a big impact that really no individual business can have any control over, but which potentially has a negative impact. And my main concern here is that it will eventually undermine the market. If really everyone starts automating jobs, and we either have unemployment, or maybe we have wages driven down to a very low level because jobs are getting de-skilled and there's more competition for the jobs that are out there, what it means is that people at large are going to have less discretionary income. They're going to have less to spend. And so there's less market demand out there for everyone. So it's a little bit, to me, it's not unlike a bunch of fishermen going out into the ocean and they're all fishing as much as they can, but collectively they're depleting the resource there. And you can sort of think about this problem in those terms. And what I think most economists would agree with, speaking in terms of the general tragedy of the commons problem, like overfishing a resource, is that there's a role for government there. Government's got to do something. Either they got to regulate it and stop the fishermen from taking too many fish, or they got to come up with some other solution. And I think that what we should be doing is figuring out a way to essentially restock the ocean or the lake by making sure that enough income is out there so that people have sufficient demand to buy the products and services being sold. And one really effective way to do that, I think, is, again, some kind of a basic or guaranteed income.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess what Switzerland was it that defeated this sort of motion of a guaranteed income?
Right. They had an actual referendum on this. And one thing to note is that it was very generous. I mean, it was 2,500 Swiss francs, which is, you know, between $2,500 and $3,000 a month, which is much higher than any realistic proposal I've seen for, you know, a guaranteed income. Most of the proposals that I've heard are more in the $1,000 or 1,000 euro a month range, or maybe even less than that. So it was very generous. It was, you know, overwhelmingly rejected by the Swiss people. But on the other hand, about 20% did vote for it. So that, I think, is something that shows that the issue is getting out there and getting some traction. I mean, the fact that they had to vote at all is pretty remarkable. The country that is maybe more interesting is Finland, which is a country that is very seriously contemplating moving in that direction in terms of their entire social safety net, and they're formulating some pilot projects to try to, you know, look into that. And I think that's a very positive thing. I think at the point we are now, that's probably what we need. We need experiments. I mean, obviously, this has never been done before on a national scale, so it would be, I mean, a mistake to assume that we can just sit down and craft the details of a strategy and get it to work the first time. That's not very likely or realistic, I don't think. What we're going to need to do is do small projects, experiments, and we need to generate data, and then we can study that and then figure out how to craft, you know, a program that can be rolled out. And of course, that program may be very different for different countries and so forth. But I think that's the point we're at right now. And that's really what I try to accomplish when I go around and talk about this, is mostly get people thinking about it and try to open minds. Because I think many people have a very, very negative feeling about this. And I think that, you know, it's something that we need to get people a bit more open-minded about, and hopefully generate some actual experiments so that we can figure how this is going to work in the real world.
Do you think it's going to have an impact on financial inclusion?
Well, I think that it's one way to address inequality. You know, inequality is just becoming a big issue throughout the world, especially in developed countries. I mean, you know, to some extent, you can say that inequality in and of itself is not necessarily a problem. The real question is, how are all the average people and the below average people doing? You know, are they thriving? Are they having a decent life? Are they financially secure? Are they under constant stress? You know, which is degrading their health and leading them to be very unhappy and potentially, you know, at the point where you could have some sort of a revolt or uprising. And there's evidence to suggest that that's getting to be a real problem in a lot of countries. In the U.S., in the United States, I mean, you know, if you're not in the top 20% of the income distribution, I mean, you may well be really struggling. And that's not good. We're talking about 80% of the people. So I think we need to address that, not just because of inequality per se, but because we need to ensure that everyone in our society, you know, has at least a decent lifestyle and living in a society that is as advanced as ours and as wealthy as ours and has the technological capability that we have. We should not have people living on the street. You know, we should not have people under tremendous levels of stress regarding their basic economic security, you know, whether they're going to have a place to live, whether they're going to have enough food to eat. You know, I don't think we should have people necessarily worried about that. I don't think that, you know, a lot of people will say that it's important in capitalism to have an incentive, right? You've got to, otherwise you'll be lazy and you'll do nothing if you don't have an incentive to work. And there's certainly truth to that, but I don't think that incentive has to be so extreme that people are threatened by homelessness and hunger, you know, in a country like the United States. I mean, I think that we can moderate the extremes a bit.
Well, it's, you know, it's just a fascinating area. And I know that these are discussions occurring at the UN level as well, and the impact it's going to have, and even some concerns that automation will remove the sort of path that developing countries have traditionally had for wealth. And that is cheap labor. Automation is cheaper than cheap labor, perhaps even more efficient. So
that's right. I mean, for developing countries, it's the the path to wealth or to success has always been factories, right? You build these big factories and people take these jobs, which many people consider to be sweatshop jobs and so forth, but they're better than the alternative for those people, and that's how they begin moving up that ladder. However, we're already seeing, you know, companies like Nike that have companies in Indonesia, for example, where they've got all these, you know, very unskilled, low-wage workers. They're moving heavily toward automation. In some cases, they're bringing the factories back to the developed world, but of course, then they're automated. There was an example recently of Adidas bringing a factory back to Germany, for example. And of course, then it's going to be all robots, you know, making the shoes. But you know, that has many advantages because now their factory is closer to their market. They're going to be able to get their product into the hands of consumers faster. Eventually, that will lead to more opportunity for customization and so forth. And you know, it's hard for a factory in a remote third world location to compete with that, you know, because of the distance from markets and so forth. So that's a trend that I think is going to make it very difficult for those countries that have not gotten on that path to prosperity yet to accomplish that. So we need to rethink that. Country is going to succeed in the future.
Yeah, and that's an interesting conversation. I keynoted at a summit called the Digital Africa Summit not too long ago. In fact, it was June, and I formed an advisory board. And it's a big question for them in terms of transforming the continent. You know, about 1.1 billion people, and a lot of these paths are disappearing. So, you know, what are you going to do? So, you know, Martin, you foreshadowed all of this, and you're just sort of this giant that was able to see these things happening. So, you know, great conversation on that area. Now, I'm going to shift directions because you've got so many different talents. For example, you founded a software company, and you know, today you hear about agility and that being key, and this agility idea is also associated with startups, or even launching a new product or service in a larger enterprise. Can you talk more about that? You know, what you see as some of the key steps for being a successful startup or for enterprises when they're trying to produce innovation?
Well, I think that, you know, the key is to be very open-minded and, you know, as an individual, to be educated relatively broadly, because a lot of it is seeing opportunities that, you know, aren't necessarily just a technical issue. You know, you really need to understand society and the way it works and the economy, and if you're going to perceive these opportunities. I mean, you can look at examples. The guys that started companies like Uber and Airbnb. I mean, these are not really technology things. They're you know, how can you solve a problem in the real world? And probably if you're going to start a business like that, it's probably more helpful to have experience in a specific industry or that area than it is to have the technology background. I mean, you can always find people that can do technology, but it's more important to have that broad-based experience. I mean, just to give another example, there's a company I talk about in my book called Momentum Machines in San Francisco that's building a robot to make hamburgers. But the guys that founded that company aren't robotic engineers. I mean, they're people that worked in the restaurant industry and perceived the problems there, and then were able to, you know, bring that together with the technology and build a team. So I think that there's a strong argument, you know, both in terms of individuals, the way you should educate yourself, and also in terms of the kinds of teams that you want in companies, that you really want a range of experience. You know, you just don't want a bunch of narrow nerds that can program. You want really a broad-based approach, and that's how you really are innovative and how you see opportunities, I think.
Now, we talked about the success of your books and how you're innovative ahead of time in terms of thought leadership, and you shared some of the attributes required for companies to be successful or startups to be successful. Are there any other areas, particularly related to computing, that you think needs to be brought into focus for discussion?
Well, there are lots of areas. As I said, there's virtual reality. What's that going to mean for society? Are we going to end up with a lot of people essentially zoned out, almost like an addictive drug? You know, there if you look at the trends in technology, there are a lot of things coming together. I think artificial intelligence and machine learning are probably the biggest thing that's happening right now with the biggest potential for disruption. But I also think it's very important to think about how these trends intertwine with other important things. I mean, obviously, the whole world is not just about technology. I worry a lot about climate change, for example. I worry about resource depletion. I worry about the fact that water, access to clean water, is becoming more and more limited for a lot of countries. And the thing that kind of concerns me is that if you look at the people that are focused on all these issues, they tend to be pretty tribal, you know, they're separate groups of people. The technology people are over here, and they're all very optimistic because they think technology is going to solve everything. And then you've got the people that are really focused on climate change, and they're extraordinarily pessimistic, and they think we're going to need to have an economy that doesn't grow anymore, and so forth. And there's not a lot of, it seems to me, collaboration or effort to really get together and think about how all of these trends are going to interact. And that, I think, will be a huge issue. One thing that in particular that I worry about is the impact of AI and robots and automation, if it really makes people less economically secure, so that they're worried about their job, they're worried about how to pay their rent, then it's almost impossible to imagine that people in that situation are really going to be, you know, heavily motivated to undertake what we need to do to control climate change. And of course, the forces that are opposed to doing anything about climate change, for example, are going to leverage that, right? They're going to say, hey, if you do something about this, even more jobs are going to be threatened, or it's going to undermine the economy. And you, of course, you see that already. And that will resonate more and more as people become less and less secure. So I really think that if we want to solve these problems, we need to think more holistically. You know, we need to think about all of these things. So the people that are really, their whole life is worrying about climate change, they better be thinking about inequality too, and what technology means for the future, and how inequality could be a lot worse if we don't really address this. So I'd really like to see a lot more interaction between the people who are focused on these various trends, because they're all going to kind of unfold in parallel, you know, roughly at the same time. And that, I think, it really kind of raises the risk of what you might call a perfect storm, where a bunch of things, you know, kind of impact simultaneously, and we're really not very well prepared for it.
So, Martin, we're going to shift directions a little bit here and sort of go to you personally and sort of your life history and the successes you've had and how you've been able to master the challenges. So can you talk or share some stories about challenges you faced and how you were able to solve them?
Well, I mean, my life has been probably not too different than a lot of people. I was actually born in the United Kingdom, and I lived there until I was four, and I moved to the United States. So my father was in the military, so we moved pretty much every year. And I guess that was a challenge for me, you know, growing up is always being in a different school in a different environment, and it's had, I think, an impact on me in both positive and negative ways, I suppose. So I'm always been a person that's very comfortable with variety. You know, I talk to other people and they say, you know, I've had this friend since first grade, and I really don't have those kind of long-term interactions because I was always in different places. Maybe that has in some way equipped me for a world that's more turbulent and where things change more rapidly. I suppose that's one possibility. But again, it has positive and negative aspects. And then I studied engineering at the University of Michigan. I worked in way back when I worked in the mini computer industry, industry that of course doesn't exist anymore. But one thing that's interesting is that when I was in high school, I read a book that was called The Soul of a New Machine. And I don't know how many people have heard of that book, but at the time it was a very important book. It actually won the Pulitzer Prize. It was written by a guy named Tracy Kidder, and it was all about a company called Data General, which was in the mini computer industry, and how they built their next generation mini computer. And it was, to me, a fascinating book, and it's one of the reasons that I decided to go into computer engineering. And then just coincidentally, after I graduated from college, I ended up working for that company, and so I got to actually meet a lot of the people that were in that book. So you can see at an early age, I was always very attracted by books. And, I was kind of fascinated by the idea that someday I might write a book, even back then. So I think it's kind of interesting the way things have all sort of come together. And now I've actually written a book of my own. But anyway, I started in that company. Then I worked there for several years. Then I decided to change. I wanted to be more of a business person. And so I went back to UCLA and got an MBA. And then I graduated from there. And then I worked in a finance job in a startup company here in Silicon Valley, but didn't really enjoy working in finance too much. I found that I really enjoyed engineering more than I thought I did, so that I wanted to get more back to the technical side. So I, after about a year and a half, that company ran into trouble and laid everybody off, basically. So I at that point, started my own software business, and it was initially a business focused on building software for Microsoft Windows. And this was the time in the mid-1990s when Microsoft Windows was the big force in technology. You know, it's when you think about social media today or the internet, I mean, it was back then it was Windows. So I basically found a niche. I developed some technical products for Microsoft Windows, and it was a very small company. I started it all by myself, basically at home working on a computer, and developed some software and eventually built that into a, not a big company, but a sustainable company that provided a good income. And that's what I did for, really many years until I got into this idea of writing. And part of the reason that I began thinking about this issue of artificial intelligence and automation is that I saw in my own small business the impact that it was having. When I started the business, creating and shipping software was pretty labor-intensive. Software at that time was shipped on CD-ROMs, and it had to be put into a box and sent to the customer. And so there were a lot of jobs there for, average people. I actually outsourced a lot of that to another company in the Bay Area that specialized in doing software fulfillment for small software companies. And there was a lot of work there. They hired people that didn't necessarily have a lot of education, and that's what they did. They put all the software in the box and they sent it to the customer. And that worked great, but within just a few years, everything changed, and that business that did that was out of business, and software, of course, was then delivered electronically, and now it's maybe not delivered at all. It's hosted in the cloud and so forth. So that trend that was really obvious to me was what got me to thinking that, I'm seeing this in software, but this is going to become much more broad-based. As you have AI and robots invading every industry, this is something that's going to be much more widespread. And that's really what motivated me to write that first book. And I began thinking about that maybe back in 2007, 2008, somewhere in that range. So I've had a pretty varied career doing, working and also doing things for myself. And I think that is really given me a lot of insight that maybe has led to the point where I, sat down and really been able to articulate some of this in the form of books.
Now, you have many interests. Any others that you want to talk about?
Well, I'm someone that reads a lot. I have, I read about everything. As I said, I'm really interested in the environment and in climate change. I'm interested in history and what it means for the future, so I read very broadly. Other than that, I really enjoy traveling. I do a lot of travel. Now, fortunately, I'm really lucky to go on a lot of speaking engagements all over the world. And whenever I travel to these, I try to get out and see these places that I'm traveling to, and spend at least part of my time being a tourist, because I think it's really, really important to see different cultures and different people who speak different languages and really understand it in a holistic way if you want to understand how all this is unfolding everywhere. Because obviously, countries and cultures are very, very different, and you see the positives and the negatives. When I was in China, just to give you one example, I was doing a talk, and before I got up to talk, there was a professor at one of the top universities there, and he said that he had actually written a paper which made an argument very similar to the one that I've been making, that technology is going to eliminate a lot of jobs. And he uploaded that to, the university website, and lots of people started to download it. And it got to the point that something like 100,000 people had actually downloaded this academic paper. And at that point, of course, the Chinese government sort of woke up and realized what was going on, and they just put a stop to it. They said, nope, no more. So that really, you know, that kind of thing really gives you a sense of what it's like to live in a society where, you know, you don't have the same kind of freedom to discuss issues and the freedom of thought that we have. And that, you know, that I think that it's really important for everyone to understand that a lot of countries are like that. And really one of the things that we all need to do is really, you know, guard our liberty. So, you know, I think that it's really important to be curious about the world and to really grab a hold of every opportunity you have to learn about everything, basically. And that's part of the things, that's one of the things that makes you in a better position to really deal with the kind of disruptive change that I think we're going to see, you know, over the next couple of decades.
Now, Martin, you've already described many facets in your history of life. And if you went even back further to the age of four, are there any other milestones that you think were pivotal in your sort of life journey?
Well, at the age of four, you said?
And onwards, yeah.
Oh, certainly moving to the United States was a big deal. I mean, I don't know what my life would have been like if I'd stayed in the United Kingdom, but I do think that this is a country that offers tremendous opportunity. I mean, I was fortunate to go to high school in Michigan, which is a state that has a very, very good, you know, public university, the University of Michigan. I mean, I didn't come from a wealthy family. My father was a non-commissioned Air Force officer. So, you know, the access to public education and financial aid and all of that was really important to me. And I utilized that both at University of Michigan and then later at UCLA. So I'm a huge proponent of making public education accessible and making sure that we preserve our great public universities in the United States. I think that starting my own business and having that be, you know, at least a reasonable success. And, you know, the business I started did not turn out to be a big Silicon Valley startup where you get venture capital and all that. It was just a small business that I ran, you know, fairly successfully. But still, that was a huge milestone for me, and I think it really transformed my life. One thing that it did is it gave me a lot of freedom. I mean, you can argue that I made somewhat different choices from a lot of people. I mean, you look at the people in Silicon Valley that do startups, and they, I mean, they have an extraordinary focus on that. They spend, you know, their whole lives focused on that. They don't have time for anything else. You can argue that maybe I took a little bit different track, and I ran a successful business, but I also left some time for me to think about other things, and that's one of the reasons that I was able to, you know, sit down and write a book. So I think that, you know, having my own business and actually sort of leveraging that into some level of freedom to actually have a little bit more control over my life than someone might have if they were working for someone else was also really important. So, I mean, those are a couple of the things that I point to.
Now, if we were to sort of expand the topic areas, do you see any three broader challenges or up to three broader challenges facing us today and any sort of solutions that you propose?
Well, you know, as I said, I think that all of these challenges kind of intersect. I mean, certainly the technology trend that I'm talking about, even if you don't buy into that completely and you're skeptical of the idea that automation is going to eliminate a lot of jobs. I mean, it's undeniable that the world is just becoming more and more unequal, or at least in advanced countries we're becoming more and more unequal. And that's, you know, clearly leading to some real problems. I mean, it leads to political capture problems in the United States where you've got extraordinarily wealthy people that have got too much influence. And as a result of that, our government is really not very responsive to average people. I mean, if you just look at what's happened to the Republican Party, that becomes obvious, right? I mean, the whole rebellion that you see among the Republicans is that, you know what, the average people who vote Republican are not well served by the policies supported by the Republican elite. I mean, you know, you look at what this party has been doing, and what they advocate, for example, is cutting the social safety net, cutting entitlements, cutting Social Security and cutting Medicare and so forth. And for the average Republican voter, the average person, that's crazy. I mean, that's all they have. The only thing they have is Social Security and Medicare. And I mean, these are not all wealthy people, right? The people that actually run the Republican Party are wealthy, but the average voters are not. And that's why you see this huge gap opening up between what the party elite wants and what the average, you know, voters want. And unfortunately, that has resulted in Donald Trump. And you're seeing more and more of that throughout the world, you know. There's just a disconnect between the elite that runs government and is doing really well and the average people out there. And maybe one of the most important parts of my message is that that's going to get worse, you know, that technology is going to keep driving that to more and more extremes if we don't do something about it. And that's just going to result in all kinds of turbulence. And it's going to, as I say, undermine our ability to solve other problems. Things like climate change, things like the fact that, you know, many countries are basically running out of water. You know, they're utilizing their water resources. I mean, this is just a huge problem. I mean, you know, it's not something that we should minimize. And to have the political capital to tackle these problems, we've got to have a civil society and reasonable distributions of wealth and people that are reasonably secure in their homes and their incomes and so forth, or it's going to be impossible to take on these trends. So that's sort of the thing that I worry about the most going forward.
Martin, you mentioned earlier that you've had this extraordinary opportunity to travel the world, and you're being invited to really interesting events and meeting, you know, some really fascinating people from around the world. And you've got a history of traveling and having diversity and I would say inclusion in your experiences. Do you have any stories that you can share that you think are maybe surprising or amazing, unexpected, amusing?
Well, you know, China was amazing to me. I mean, because this country has just made such extraordinary progress. And I went to Beijing and Shanghai, you know, it was just an amazing experience to me. I had a chance to look around both cities a bit, and I was struck by the level of pollution, for example, in Beijing. It's a real concern, and I really hope they work on that. But overall, I just found that it seemed in many ways to just be like a developed country to me. I mean, from what I saw, I mean, which is just extraordinary. You know, if you look at where this country has come from, and I found that when I spoke to groups of people, that they're just extraordinarily in tune with these trends and curious about them. A lot of more than other places, you know, that a lot of the questions that I got in China when I was speaking were more entrepreneurial. They were, you know, how can we start a business to you know, leverage these technologies? How can I start a robotic startup? I mean, I get those questions, you know, much more in China than in other countries. And it's not necessarily my area of expertise. I mean, obviously I'm more focused on what all this means for society and stuff. So that was kind of interesting. I got a really interesting question in China, which I, at the time, and this was in July of last year. And the question was, what will it mean for the United States when Donald Trump is president? And I sort of disparaged that. I said, you know, that's kind of a silly question. I mean, I don't think that that's at all possible. And it turned out, of course, that maybe they were more in tune than I was. And so it's really interesting to see their perception of the United States, and which is, I think, generally very positive. We make a lot of this rivalry between the U.S. and China and stuff, but that's not what I saw. I saw that they tend to hold us in very high regard. At least the people that I talk to, and I think that really is very positive for the future. So, you know, I don't necessarily have dramatic stories to tell you, but I think it's a fascinating experience, and I think that it's something that I would encourage for everyone. Obviously, not everyone has that opportunity. You know, one of the hopes I have in terms of technology, you look at things like virtual reality, is that maybe it will make travel more accessible and more affordable, you know, that even those people that don't have the means to physically travel the world, once virtual reality goes mainstream, they will have that opportunity to visit other cultures, other cities, other countries, and emerge in those places in a way that you might not be able to with, you know, watching a movie or something, and that maybe will help to open up the world and bring this sort of cosmopolitan experience to a lot of people that right now don't have the opportunity to enjoy that, because I think it's really, really important.
Martin, we're down to our last question, and I'm going to sort of turn the tables. And the question is, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I think that, well, I'm not sure I can come up with any others. You've covered it pretty solidly, but I would say that the biggest question is, you know, what do we do as a society about this, and how are we going to bring about that change? And I think that the answer is that in the future, we're going to have to find a way to move to a different economic model, and we're going to have to move away from this idea that everyone has got to have a job, and everyone has got to have a job that pays enough for them to survive economically and also, you know, to be a consumer. And, you know, that's a model that actually hasn't been present throughout human history. You know, I mean, it's only been really within the last maybe 100 years or so that we've had this sort of career focus where everyone's got to work. And only since the Industrial Revolution that we've really moved from a world where people were pretty much self-sufficient, working, you know, living on farms, to really having to have jobs. And the fact that that has happened doesn't mean that it's going to be the case forever. You know, I think we're going to have to accept the fact that change may be coming again, and we're going to have to accept yet another transition into something else. And I think that the challenge for us is going to figure out how to craft a society where people have access to an income, and where they also have important things to do, where they have a sense of self-worth and a sense of accomplishments and a sense that they are an important component of society and that they're contributing something, but where those two things, the income and that sense of fulfillment and having an important place in society, don't necessarily come from the same place the way they do today. You know, right now we look to our job and our career as really the vehicle that gives us both the income and that sense of belonging and that sense of purpose. And, you know, I think that in the future maybe we're going to get those things from different places, and we have to figure out a way to make that happen. And that's just going to be an incredible challenge, both for politicians and leaders and both for us as individuals. And the most important thing that I'm doing right now is trying to begin that conversation, you know, get people thinking about that and thinking of at least opening their minds to the possibility that maybe the future is not going to be the same as the present, and that we need to really, really start thinking about how we're going to craft that future.
You know, it almost sounds like Gene Roddenberry in the 1960s.
Yeah, I think Star Trek is a great sort of model to think about. I mean, Star Trek is very utopian. It's not like other science fiction that's dystopian. And the thing I always say is that, you know, if you watch Star Trek, there's nobody digging ditches, or there probably aren't people sitting around and doing boring desk jobs either. And yet people have good lives. If you think about the implications of all that technology, I don't think people really have to work. Certainly not everyone's got they've got nanotech technology fabrication and stuff. They can, you know, go and create anything they want. And so it's not a world where people have to work for a living, and yet it's a very utopian society. So it's sort of, you can think of that as kind of the end game, the thing that we're moving towards. And you know, it's going to be a long, long time before we are in that world, but our question is, how do we transition to that? And I think that's, you know, really an important question for us. But the really important message there is that a world without jobs and traditional careers and all, it can be a very positive world where people have great lives and still undertake great challenges, you know, and that's something that's a way of thinking that I think is very useful. It's something that we need to sort of come around to.
Martin, I just really want to thank you for spending the time. I know you're really, really busy, and you've got such a demanding schedule because you're a giant and providing all of these insights to the world. So we are indeed fortunate that you came in to do this interview, and thank you for sharing so many of your deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thanks a lot. It was really great to be here, and I certainly appreciate you having me.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Martin, a globally renowned writer, best-selling author, keynote, and futurist.